Today is Tuesday, the 20th of July, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. A new government may be sworn into office in Haiti.
The new key player is going to be Ariel Henry, the one that was nominated by the president before he died.
Plus, what happened on the first day of relaxed COVID-19 protocols in England?
The celebration started at midnight when nightclubs reopened for the first time in a while, and that meant that there were queues around the block.
And spider venom that could possibly save lives. We'll have these stories and more. Next. Haiti's acting prime minister says that he's stepping down to make way for a political challenger who has more international backing. Claude Joseph, who has been acting prime minister since the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse on July 7th, told the Washington Post that he was leaving office. Anne Rose Schoen joins us from Pensionville, Haiti, with the latest updates.
There is meeting from all the new ministers this afternoon, and the government is supposed to be installed tomorrow, which coincides with the commemoration of the memory of the president, which was supposed to be happening tomorrow from 10 to 1. So for the time being, nobody really knows what's going to happen, whether this is going to happen from 10 to 1, because the people that were in charge before are not in charge anymore because there is a new government. And this government is meeting apparently this afternoon or tonight and will be sworn in tomorrow morning.
Anne Rose, you mentioned a lot of the unknowns surrounding this new government. The U.S. State Department, when asked about it, could not confirm that Claude Joseph was in fact stepping down. But what do we know about who the key players are going to be should the new government be installed?
The new key player is going to be Ariel Henry, the one that was nominated by the president before he died. And two ministers are going to be the stay. Apparently, the Minister of Economics, as far as I heard, is going to stay. And then there is the Minister of Justice. It's going to stay. There's a new one coming in, which is one of the opposition head figures. And it's supposedly also Dr. Claude Joseph is supposedly to be the Minister of Foreign Affairs.
Now, Anne Rose, as you mentioned, the installation of the new government is supposed to take place at the same time that originally a commemoration of slain President Jovenel Moïse was scheduled to begin and kick off 3 days of celebration of his life, culminating with his burial on July the 23rd. What can you tell us about these events that are scheduled?
I mean, nobody knows whether it's going to happen tomorrow, but suppose because tomorrow there was the big event at the museum, the Central Museum in Port-au-Prince, that's called MIPANA. And the First Lady was supposed to receive. And during this event, there was supposed to be singing. There was supposed to be dignitaries coming from all over the world, what I heard. And also what I heard, it was the Ministry of the Protocol, Ministry of the protocol of the palace was asking for spontaneous speeches of dignitaries who would like to commemorate their impressions of the president, Jovenel Moïse. But right now, nobody knows what's going to happen. And it is very possible that this event is going to be canceled because the inauguration of the new government is apparently at the same moment, so it might be pushed off to Wednesday.
Anne Rose Schoen reports from Pensionville, which is located just outside the capital of Port-au-Prince in Haiti. The United States, along with NATO, the European Union, the United Kingdom, Japan, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, specifically blame China for a cyber attack in March that affected tens of thousands of organizations via Microsoft Exchange servers. White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman joins us with the details.
Right. Well, they're pretty clearly blaming this on hackers in China. And then they're also drawing a link between hackers in China and China's a civilian intelligence agency. Now, President Biden said he's going to receive a detailed report about all this Tuesday, and what this involved back in March is tens of thousands of organizations that use Microsoft Exchange servers suffered what's called a zero-day hack. This is where a vulnerability is known to the software vendor, but they don't have a patch in place yet to fix the flaw. So they believe, meaning they, the United States, along with NATO, the European Union, and these other countries, that this was a sophisticated action, and that China's intelligence agency may have been aware of that there were people in China behind this.
Steve, has the administration announced what the next step will be? And I bring that up because when President Biden met with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Europe not too long ago, he did indicate that perhaps the United States would take action against individuals in Russia that the U.S. feels is responsible for cyber attacks here in the United States. So what is the United States going to do? Do these individuals they say are responsible for the zero-day attack on Microsoft Exchange servers that they feel are operating out of China?
Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, was asked about that, that essentially, and the president was also asked that you're naming and shaming, but not punishing. The president fended that question off to some degree, but the press secretary answered it more directly. She said, that they will not be allowing any economic circumstances or consideration to prevent the administration from taking actions where warranted, and also reserves the option to take additional actions where warranted as well. And that this is not the conclusion of our efforts is what she said in regards to both China and Russia, saying that today. So the answer from the White House essentially is stay tuned.
Speaking of staying tuned, I know that there is a time difference between here in Washington and Beijing, but has the Chinese government responded to any of these allegations in the past?
Back in mid-March, when a Chinese foreign ministry spokesman was asked about this, because there were allegations from some private countries that sophisticated network intrusions were coming from China with this Microsoft server exchange hack. And the spokesman replied that they would take the allegations seriously with reliable proof, but they weren't really going to spend their time responding to rumors and speculation. Well, now what we have laid out by these countries goes beyond what the Chinese government was requesting. There's a very detailed report that the National Security Agency, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency have put out, where they're listing, you know, what China did and how they did it. And really now the ball is in Beijing's court to respond to this.
Steve Herman is VOA's White House Bureau Chief. A spokesperson for the Chinese embassy in Washington told Reuters News, quote, the Chinese government and relevant personnel never engage in cyber attacks or cyber theft, end quote. Foreign diplomatic missions in Afghanistan called for the Taliban on Monday to urgently cease their military offensive, saying it runs counter to claims that the insurgent group wants a negotiated settlement to the war. It comes a day after the Taliban and senior Afghan government envoys ended a two-day meeting in Qatar without reporting any significant progress on peace talks. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. The leader of the Belarusian opposition, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, is on her first official tour of the United States. Her in-person talks with high-ranking U.S. officials will be closely watched not only in Belarus, but also in Moscow, which views its eastern neighbor as part of its sphere of influence. VOA's Igor Tiskaneka sat down for this exclusive interview.
Her motorcade pulls up for her first interview on American soil. Ahead is a busy week of meetings with high-ranking U.S. officials. The leader of Belarusian opposition, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, who lives in exile in Lithuania, is on her first official visit to Washington at the invitation of the U.S. State Department. And she is straightforward about why she took that transatlantic flight from Europe.
I want the USA to keep Belarus on the agenda. And my main purpose, of course, is talk about Belarus, about the situation, about escalation of violence from the side of the regime.
Tikhanovskaya had to leave Belarus with two minor children after a brutal crackdown on peaceful protesters following a contested election on August 9th of last year, in which incumbent President Alexander Lukashenko claimed victory for a sixth consecutive time. She says America's help is needed in her country.
I call on the USA to be with us. It's very important when a regime is destroying everything in Belarus, destroying mass media, destroying all the organizations. It's extremely important to support all those people.
One of the outstanding issues for democratic Belarus and Tikhanovskaya personally is the release of more than 500 political prisoners arrested by authorities during the crackdown. Her husband, Sergei, is one of them.
And the only way out how to release prisoners is put political, economical pressure on them. And I'm sure that it will happen rather soon.
Tikhanovskaya's meetings in Washington will be closely watched not only in Minsk. Russian President Vladimir Putin, who views Belarus as his political backyard, will be observant as well.
Doesn't necessarily want to see, one, a fellow autocrat that he perceives to be part of his sphere of influence fall. He certainly doesn't want to see democracies rise, you know, on Russia's border.
The U.S. political establishment understands that quite well, but says the ties of the two are not unbreakable.
There has not been a smooth relationship between Russia and Belarus over a period of time.
Increasing the political and especially economic pressure on Lukashenko is what can make him toxic, even for Putin, U.S. lawmakers say.
So what needs to change is there's got to be a higher price for him paying. That means double down on the sanctions.
Meanwhile, despite the sweeping sanctions imposed by the United States, the European Union and others on the Belarusian regime at the end of June, the country's civil society and media organizations were hit with yet another wave of arbitrary arrests and detentions last week. Igor Tikhonenko, VOA News, Washington.
On July 16th, Belarusian authorities detained Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty correspondent Ailes Daschensky. RFERL is a sister news organization of VOA and part of the U.S. Agency for Global Media. The Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty report says that Daschensky's journalist accreditation was canceled last October as part of President Alexander Lukashenko's campaign against dissent and free media. His detainment came on the same day as police and security forces raided the offices and homes of several independent journalists across Belarus, including RFERL's offices in Minsk. Germany's interior minister has rejected criticism of the country's flood warning system as devastated and bereaved residents begin to clear up their country's worst disaster in decades. Reuters' Lucy Fielder is up next.
A huge pile of damaged property bears witness to the devastation wrought by last week's deadly floods. As Germany's interior minister rejected criticism that the government failed to warn people. On a tour of stricken areas on Monday, including this dam, which was at risk of breach, forcing mass evacuations. The floods that tore through Western Europe killed more than 160 people in Germany alone, making it the country's worst natural disaster in almost six decades.
Wir sollten daran nicht rütteln.
Horst Seehofer said flood warnings were up to local authorities because they require local knowledge. An expert on flooding at the UK's Reading University, Hannah Cloak, said the scale of the death and destruction in Europe showed the need for a new approach.
So I could see this information at the beginning of the week, and it looked very serious. It looked like a very worrying flood. So I was very surprised, really, at the scale of the death and destruction, because from my point of view, it looked like we could forecast this event coming. So something is going wrong in the communication chain of these warnings. Something is going wrong and people don't really understand how much risk they're in, perhaps.
The European floods began on Wednesday and have mainly hit the German states of Rhineland-Palatinate and North Rhine-Westphalia, as well as parts of Belgium. The DWD Weather Service warned last Monday that heavy rain was heading to western Germany and that flooding was very likely. On Wednesday morning, it said on Twitter that the risk of flooding was increasing and called on the population to seek guidance from local authorities. The floods cut off entire communities without power or communications. The German government is readying a relief package for hard-hit communities. One government source told Reuters immediate relief worth around 400 million euros or $340 million was under discussion.
Lucy Fielder of Reuters News. Residents in Britain celebrated the end of coronavirus lockdown restrictions on Monday, and something that they're calling Freedom Day. The day ushered in an end to all restrictions, which were imposed to fight the spread of COVID-19. Victoria Smith is in London, and I spoke to her about how the day went down.
Well, I can tell you, Steve, that the celebration started at midnight when nightclubs reopened for the first time in a while, and that meant that there were queues around the block. Of course, some youngsters turned 18 when this whole pandemic began and have had to wait all this time to get into nightclubs. So they did their waiting last night, and there were lots of scenes of young people and not so young people on the streets trying to get back into nightclubs. Of course, Freedom Day means no social distancing, no limits on large gatherings, indoor and out, and no masks. And I can tell you, I've been on a London bus today, and we were divided. There were half of us wearing masks, half of us not wearing masks, and everybody looking around just to see what everyone else is doing. So there's a real sense of a divided opinion here in the UK because of Freedom Day. And all of this because, of course, cases are continuing to rise, and our Prime Minister and two of his senior members of government are self-isolating. The figures, Steve, are around 50,000 new cases a day. Now, that takes us almost up to the levels of the wave last winter. The difference is the reason why we've gone ahead with this Freedom Day is the prediction there will be fewer hospitalizations and deaths. So the government is calling it a sweet spot, a time when, if not now, when? That's Boris Johnson's newest mantra. He's saying schools are breaking up for the summer. The good weather means people can meet outside still. So now is the time to do it. But is it? At a news conference earlier on today, he and his team sounded decidedly nervous. And they urged us all to ease back into normality very slowly. And of course, the irony that he led this national press conference while in self-isolation himself meant there were some very mixed messages coming out on Freedom Day today.
So how are these concerns being managed? Because there's some reporting that, you know, Freedom Day was also a pingdemic. You know, when we spoke on yesterday, you mentioned this national health app that would ping you, alert you to know that if you were in close contact with someone who had tested positive. So moving forward, what is the strategy since you are riding this crest of new infections?
Well, the strategy appears to be an experiment. We're the only country in Europe that's trying this, what is, to be honest, an experiment in herd immunity. We know the infections will rise. They'll rise a lot to over 1,000 hospitalizations a day. The risk of getting long COVID, which we're just beginning to learn about, that will rise. And of course, the virus could mutate again because although the vaccination program is going well here, it's still got a way to run. Some 35% of the population and not yet double jabbed. And yet, as you mentioned, Steve, because more of us are going to get infected and spread the infection, we're all going to be pinged by this National Health Service app telling us to self-isolate. I've been pinged 3 times already before Freedom Day because apparently the Bluetooth goes through walls, and if there's somebody in the next room at work that's been exposed, then you get pinged too. So the whole idea was Freedom Day was to sort of help out the economy. But what's happening is because so many people are being pinged and told to self-isolate, the economy is struggling. People can't go to work. Shops are shutting early. And there are now calls for people to delete the very app that's meant to be protecting them.
That is almost a drastic step because that would seem to, you know, be counterintuitive into preventative measures. One last question for you. You know, Boris Johnson is able to do this because he's the prime minister, and you're talking about England. Within the United Kingdom, there's also Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland, which have their own separate health policies in place. Have they commented about what they're seeing in England on this first day without COVID protocols in place?
Well, they certainly have. The Northern Ireland Deputy First Minister, Michelle O'Neill, she says she's quite disturbed by some of the scenes here in England on Freedom Day, as I say, we've been celebrating since midnight, and she's calling the Prime Minister's plan reckless. Now, all the other nations that you've mentioned, they will eventually be relaxing some of their restrictions from later this month, some in August, but there'll be more caution exercised in all of those countries. For example, face masks will remain on public transport and social gatherings will be smaller. So England is kind of going it alone when it comes to returning to so-called normality. And yes, that has attracted some criticism from the other nations that will be watching and waiting to see what happens next.
Reporter Victoria Smith in London. In Vietnam, Hanoi officials are urging its citizens to stay at home and have even ordered a halt to all non-essential services due to new clusters of COVID-19 infections. Reuters' Libby Hogan reports.
16 southern provinces will face restrictions for 2 weeks as the country's daily COVID-19 cases hit a new record. Domestic flights were also suspended to and from the south until next month. The Health Ministry has sent 2,000 ventilators and tens of thousands of its most highly qualified health workers to hard-hit areas. Meanwhile, in the capital, Hanoi, citizens were told to stay at home. The city has already stopped indoor dining and closed salons and gyms. The country of 98 million has received nearly 9 million doses of COVID-19 vaccines and fewer than 300,000 people have been fully vaccinated.
Libby Hogan of Reuters News. The corruption trial of former South African President Jacob Zuma resumed Monday. He's charged with multiple counts of corruption, fraud, and racketeering in connection with a massive 1999 arms deal involving French defense giant Thales when he served as deputy president. The company has also been charged with corruption and money laundering. Zuma is currently serving a 15-month sentence for failing to appear before an inquiry into corruption. The United States on Monday released Abdul Latif Nasser from its detention center in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and sent him to his native Morocco after holding him for 19 years. He was a one-time Taliban commander in Afghanistan. It was the first transfer of a Guantanamo detainee under U.S. President Joe Biden. With Nasser's release, 39 prisoners remain at the Guantanamo facility, which at one time housed more than 700. The U.S. Justice Department announced a new policy Monday that prohibits federal prosecutors from seizing journalists' phone and email records in leak investigations. The Justice Department under former President Donald Trump had used subpoenas to obtain the communication records of reporters and others to try and track down government leakers. The Biden administration said it would discontinue the controversial practice. A Tampa, Florida man who participated in the January 6th Capitol riots will spend 8 months in prison stemming from the incident. Prosecutors had sought an 18-month sentence. The individual was never accused of assault or property damage, but pleaded guilty last month to obstructing an official proceeding. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Ethiopian police have confirmed the arrest of hundreds of ethnic Tigrayans in the capital of Addis Ababa during the recent weeks. The police say that they were supporting the Tigray's People Liberation Front, or TPLF, which authorities banned after the Tigray conflict broke out last November. But rights group Amnesty International says dozens were detained because of their ethnicity. Gilmo DeWaite has that story.
Addis Ababa Police Commissioner Gitu Argao confirmed on Saturday that authorities had arrested over 300 Tigrayans. But speaking on the state-run Ethiopian Broadcast Corporation, Getu denied the Tigrayans were arrested because of their ethnicity. He said the arrests were made after thorough investigations found the suspects were supporting Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, which authorities banned other terrorist groups in May over the conflict in Tigray. He said their arrests targeted only individuals who were supporting the ousted terrorist group, the TPLF. So I want to assure that these arrests were not due to their ethnicity, said Getu. In addition to Tigrayans, we have also arrested suspects from other ethnic groups who were involved in supporting this terrorist group, he said. and we will continue to make such arrests in the future as well. Getu said legal weapons and ammunition were seized from some of the suspects. He was responding to a call Friday by rights groups Amnesty International for Ethiopian authorities to end arbitrary detentions of Tigrayans without due process. Amnesty said the sweeping arrests appear to be ethnically motivated. The rights group said while some of the arrests were released on bail, while hundreds of others were still being detained and their relatives kept in the dark. Fesate Clay is Amnesty International's human rights researcher for Ethiopia. He tells VOA the families of those arrested do not know where they are being kept, they have not appeared in court, and this should stop. If they are involved in criminal activities, they should appear before court, says Fesaha, and the family should have the right to visit them, and they should get also an attorney. The arrests come as the war in Ethiopia's Tigray region appears to be expanding. A spokesman for the neighboring Afar region on Monday said Tigray fighters attacked Afar's forces on Saturday and that clash continued over the weekend. The TPLF has also vowed to regain territory seized by Amhara forces loyal to the federal government. The conflict dates back to last November when Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed deployed government forces to oust the TPLF from power in Tigray. Ethiopian authorities announced a unilateral ceasefire in Tigray on June 28 as Tigrayan forces retook the regional capital Mekele from federal troops. But with each passing day, it looks less likely the ceasefire is going to hold. Gilbert Wright for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
And finally, venom from an Australian spider that is one of the world's deadliest could save the lives of heart attack victims. Phil Mercer rounds us out.
A potentially life-saving treatment for victims of heart attacks has been found in a most unlikely source, the venom of one of the world's deadliest spiders. The World Health Organization says cardiovascular diseases are the leading cause of death globally, taking an estimated 17.9 million lives each year. Researchers from the University of Queensland have discovered that the poison from the Fraser Island funnel-web spider in eastern Australia contains what could be a life-saving molecule or peptide. Known as HI1A, it could block so-called death signals sent to cells after a cardiac arrest when blood flow to the heart is reduced. This results in a lack of oxygen to the heart muscles, causing cells to become acidic, and a message is sent for heart cells to die. Despite decades of research, scientists haven't been able to develop a drug that stops this death signal. Australian experts have said that's one of the reasons why heart disease continues to be the leading cause of death around the world. Dr. Sarah Scheuer is a researcher at the Victor Chang Cardiac Research Institute, which is part of the spider venom study. She says the discovery could also help transplant patients.
If we're using this special little peptide, so a small portion of the funnel web spider venom, but what we found is this peptide is able to help protect the heart where there's a lack of blood supply or blood flow. And we found that this can be used both not only in heart transplantation, so when the donor heart out of the body during the transplant process, but potentially could also be used in heart attack victims to help minimize the damage that occurs.
Australian researchers believe that the molecule from spider venom blocks the heart's ability to sense acid after a cardiac arrest, disrupting the death message. They've said their vision for the future was for HI1A to be administered by first responders in the ambulance. The discovery builds on earlier work that found a small protein in the venom of the Fraser Island funnel-web spider markedly improved patients' recovery from a stroke. The protein has been tested in human heart cells, and the Australian team is aiming to start clinical trials for both stroke and heart disease within 2 to 3 years. The research was published in the journal Circulation. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.